From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. An HIV outbreak is devastating Scott County in rural Indiana. Ground zero is the town of Austin, population 4,200, poor, with high unemployment, devastated by opioid addiction, and now by HIV. Indiana Governor Mike Pence declared a state of emergency and Tuesday expanded a needle exchange program. Austin looks a lot like many other towns across the country with little opportunity, hope, and a big drug problem. This hour on Point, lessons from Austin, Indiana, and America's addiction problem. You can join us on air or online. Could Austin be your town, your city? Are needle exchanges the answer? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first this hour from Indianapolis is Jake Harper, health reporter for the NPR affiliate WFYI. Jake, thank you for being here.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So how many cases, how many confirmed cases of HIV have been reported?
Right now, we're at 150 people that have tested positive for HIV, and that includes one preliminary positive. So it's 149 confirmed.
And so what's driving the outbreak?
This is an unusual outbreak. It's being driven by opioid drug abuse. There's one specific drug called Opana, which has been linked to many of the cases. It's a time-released pill that in theory, has been formulated to basically turn into goo when you add water. But drug users have found a way to get past that by cooking it, essentially, before adding water and injecting it. It gives a really intense high and a really intense low, so people get hooked very easily. And they've been sharing needles. They don't have clean needles in their community, or they didn't until very recently, which is how the virus is spreading.
Here's Kevin Polly. He was diagnosed with HIV in Austin, Indiana. Still, he continues to use needles to inject the drug Opana that you were referring to, Jake, an opiate painkiller. CBS News correspondent Dean Reynolds asked Polly in early April if he knew what he was getting himself into.
Did you know sharing needles is risky?
I think we all knew that, but it was in the back of our minds. That was, you know, the number one priority was to get to feeling better.
Jake Harper describes Scott County and specifically Austin, Indiana, the town at the center of this outbreak.
So like you've said several times already, Austin is, it's a small community. It's 4,200, 4,300 people. It's surrounded by farmland. Historically, a lot of people moved there to work at the Morgan Foods factory that was set up, I think, over 100 years ago. It sits right off of I-65, 45 minutes north of Louisville. As you've also mentioned, there are high rates of unemployment, lots of uninsured people. And I think what's interesting, too, is that Scott County is consistently ranked last in terms of the health of its county, in terms of its health outcomes. It's 92 of 92 counties. So a lot of the warning signs were there. Obviously, we have the gift of hindsight now, but it's pretty easy to see how something like this could have happened, given everything that's going on.
This week, Governor Mike Pence declared a state of emergency and expanded the needle exchange program, as you mentioned, in Indiana. And he outlined programs to address the rise in HIV cases in Scott County.
I do not support needle exchange as anti-drug policy, but this is a public health emergency. And on the recommendation of the Centers for Disease Control, I am authorizing a focused, short-term, limited needle exchange program if local officials deem that to be necessary and appropriate to suppress the HIV epidemic.
Governor Pence previously said he would veto a broad-based needle exchange program. Jake Harper, why did he change his mind?
Well, I think at the urging of all of the health experts, the CDC, people have been telling him that the evidence is there for needle exchanges in terms of reducing the spread of HIV. So the governor has softened his stance a little bit, but I think it remains to be seen whether this bill that he signed is an actual expansion. Only time will really prove that if counties can actually go through the request process to get approval for a needle exchange in their counties.
Because what does the program entail?
Basically, individual counties have to go through a process at the local level. The health commissioner has to basically say that there's an epidemic of hepatitis C or HIV. They then have to go through a public hearing and then go through a formal request process through the State Department of Health before it will be legal in their county to operate an exchange. And time will tell how long it'll take that will happen. take that to happen, it's a political process every step of the way.
So 150 people now tested positive for HIV, an opioid problem, addiction issue for a long time. Anything else that the state is trying to do to stop this outbreak?
Yeah, well, along with this needle exchange, the state, along with local health officials, has set up a one-stop shop where people can go in. They can get signed up for health insurance. They can get signed up for they can get birth certificates. They can get limited counseling services that they offer there, and also get signed up for inpatient treatment. But one of the issues right now is that there is sort of a long waiting list at the moment. Certain people can get moved up that list. I think having HIV makes you a priority for that, but the number of beds for inpatient treatment is limited at the moment.
Jake Harper, health reporter for WFYI in Indianapolis. Thank you so much, Jake.
Thank you.
Joining me now from Anderson, Indiana, is Julie Fouts, HIV program manager at Aspire Indiana, a nonprofit community health mental health center that receives funding from the Indiana State Department of Health. She's been working with HIV patients in Scott County. Nice to have you, Julie. Thanks.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So you were called into Scott County because of this outbreak. What are you seeing? Who are you treating?
So many care coordinators from around the state have spent time in Scott County helping those individuals who are newly diagnosed with HIV to kind of navigate the healthcare system that's in place, making sure that they have the basic education about HIV, how it's transmitted, how it's not transmitted, getting them connected with insurance like the HIP 2.0, the expansion, the Medicaid program, helping with making sure they have medications, that they're seeing a doctor, that they have the support in place that they need to continue living healthy lives.
Can you share some of the stories that you've heard, some of what you've seen on the ground there, Julie?
Sure. I can, excuse me, I can tell you that the time that I spent in Austin, it really had an impact on me, in that the people that we worked with there, they seemed so unaware of what it meant to have HIV. There was a lot of, on one hand, there was a lot of fear about what that meant, and some people not wanting to get tested because they didn't want to know their status because they were afraid that it was a quote-unquote death sentence. On the other hand, there were people who were just lost in their addiction, not knowing really what the impact was of having HIV and what that meant and what services were available and what their options were. I think what hit me the most, though, is that Austin is not unlike many of the small rural towns around the state and actually probably around the country. Our services that we provide through Aspire, our HIV program covers 32 counties. The vast majority of those counties are very rural, small towns like Austin, and it's the same people in each of those small towns.
And there's generational substance abuse here as well. What about that?
There is. I know that several of the people that I talked with, they all told the same story that they get high with their parents and their siblings and their children. They get the pills from their grandparents. It was the same story over and over again. There is that generational aspect to it.
So Governor Spence declared a state of emergency, started this needle exchange program. There are many people in this community and beyond who oppose this sort of approach, who oppose the needle exchange program, saying that it perpetuates drug use. Do you agree with that? Is that a valid concern based on what you've seen?
Well, I can tell you, first off, I'm definitely not an expert when it comes to needle exchange. The research that I've done on it myself is, I believe that it's a good idea. There's so much more to it than just exchanging syringes clean for dirty. There's HIV testing is a component of that, and referrals to mental health and substance abuse treatment, referrals to other community resources, education is a big piece of that as well. So, you know, I think the more that you can embrace somebody with services and care, that's always going to be good.
We heard from Jake Harper at the beginning that this is a largely rural area, economically depressed community. One in five people lives in poverty. From your perspective, Julie, there on the ground, how does that play into this problem?
Again, you know, I think that Austin is not unlike many of the other small rural towns around the country where there is extreme poverty. I think that a lot of times there's hopelessness or a sense of just not knowing where to go and giving up. And I think that plays a big piece of it. I also think that the lack of education and awareness about what the risks are, that also comes into play.
Julie Foltz is joining us from Anderson, Indiana, HIV program manager at Aspire Indiana, a nonprofit community health mental health center that receives funding from the Indiana State Department of Health. She's been working with HIV patients in Scott County. When does this needle exchange program begin, Julie?
The needle exchange program in Scott County has been going on, I believe, since early April. It was specific to that county. So that one is in effect right now.
And are you seeing any differences? Are you seeing a change right away?
I'm not in Scott County frequently, so I really can't speak on their needle exchange program, how it's going.
We'll get to that then after the break. And we're talking about an outbreak of HIV in rural Indiana and the best way to contain the outbreak and address America's addiction problem generally. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about poverty, opioids, and an HIV outbreak in rural Indiana. Last month, Indiana lawmakers reached an agreement to expand needle exchange programs to Indiana counties at risk of an HIV epidemic. Here's Indiana Republican Representative Ed Clear, a big supporter of needle exchange programs, speaking about the agreement.
I wish we weren't doing it in response to a crisis, but I'm still glad we're having the conversation, and I think this legislation has the potential to help a lot of communities and save lives.
This hour, we're speaking with Julie Foltz, HIV program manager at Aspire Indiana, a nonprofit community mental health center. She's been working with HIV patients in Scott County. Joining me now, also from Indianapolis, is Beth Meyerson, professor in the School of Public Health at Indiana University, where she is co-director for the Rural Center for AIDS STD Prevention. Beth, nice to have you. Thanks for taking the time.
Good to be with you.
So, did this outbreak take Indiana by surprise?
I think it did take Indiana by surprise, but I don't think we should be surprised by it. As Jake had mentioned in the earlier segment, there were warning signs, and certainly the hepatitis C rates, which are very strong, robust indicators for a need for health intervention among needle users, is one. And we also knew that there are high rates of opioid mortality, death by overdose, essentially, mm-hmm. in Scott County, and so the indicators were there, and these are bad end of the line indicators: someone sick or someone dead. But if you ask people in Scott County whether they knew that they had a community within their county that was injecting drugs and injecting Opana, they would certainly tell you yes. And as had been indicated earlier, generations are at this. So, again, not a surprise probably to the people in town, probably horrified that it's HIV for stigma reasons. But to the rest of us who watch data in public health, we shouldn't be terribly surprised, which makes us concerned about counties not just all over Indiana, but all over the country.
Mm. So speaking of that data, I mean, obviously we had an AIDS epidemic in the 1980s. It's now 2015. It feels like we should know now how to stop AIDS from spreading, how to prevent an outbreak like this. What do you say to that?
Well, we should, but HIV is one of those health issues that lands in the moral policy component, which means we have trouble with sex and drugs. And so when it comes to keeping populations and generations educated, we do a pretty bad job of it. So we were talking about how people in Scott County are unaware of HIV, and I believe that Julie gave really great voice to that. Well, of course they would be. Where do they learn that? They don't learn it at home, and we don't have comprehensive sexual health education in schools, and we've been very abstinence-focused in our drug education as well. So we would not tend to have open communication about any of this. And so the learning that we can have from outbreaks and the history of these kinds of challenges to our community health, we just they just pass us by.
You talk about the moral policy component. There's also an economic component here as well. I mean, Indiana spends about $13 per person on public health generally. So that must play into this as well.
Absolutely. In fact, when we see an outbreak, so we know automatically that in populations that use injection drugs, there will be health issues associated with just the fact of injecting yourself. So with Opana, we have a larger gauge. So imagine tissue damage, et cetera. So that hepatitis C or HIV gets into that injection community is not terribly surprising, if you will. It is how fast we know about it and how fast we respond to the outbreak so that people can get care and can get tested. Is really the key. And so an outbreak like this shows the belly of the beast, that we do not invest in our system of HIV testing, of hepatitis screening, of public health all around, so that we don't build systems that are wrapping around people. So, for example, you'd mentioned the per capita state investment in public health, which is a whopping $13.08, and it puts us 44th in the country. Mm. In the county of Scott, they invest $10.84, which might sound to a listener as, oh, that's high. It's almost as high as the state. No, it's the state is so low. And so what we find is we don't have HIV testing resources. Even in Scott County prior to the epidemic, there wasn't any resource for infectious disease clinics except in Louisville. So even as we say to ourselves, gee, maybe this is just in Scott County, we don't even really know that, because it's not as if we have testing resources, HIV or hepatitis C screening resources in the surrounding counties or, frankly, in injection drug using communities throughout our state.
Well, talk more about that. So contrast those numbers with the resources needed to deal with an epidemic of this scale. 150 tested positive for HIV just in the last little while. A huge opiate addiction problem there on the ground. What do you need to battle this?
Well, so there are two things. Again, I was saying that the outbreak shows the belly of our beast, that we're not prepared and our system is kind of broken down. It does show, however, a strong state and federal coordinated outbreak response, and that we are seeing. And so that's very important. But think of the massive resources that are put into an outbreak response when, in fact, if we had invested in testing throughout the state in every county, if we had invested into evolving our primary care system so that, in fact, every clinic, every physician routinely tests for HIV. And as we move forward to rollout of HIP2O, for example, and assure that more people actually have access to coverage, and the coverage they get will screen for these things as well as for the need for behavioral intervention, as in substance abuse treatment, I think we would be further along. Now, the dollar figure to that, I have no idea, but I can tell you it's way more expensive to respond to an outbreak at three levels of government than it would be to invest fully in a public health system that would work.
Let's get a caller in here. Phyllis from Evansville, Indiana. Phyllis, glad you called. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Yes.
I would like to say that I have been reading about Austin, watching on the news, and it's a tragedy. I'm embarrassed that Indiana does not have an ongoing needle exchange. You know, I read that our governor gave a 3-month needle exchange program, extended it. I don't understand that thinking. People are going to use drugs.
And you volunteer, Phyllis, don't you, for parents? You're about 100 miles from the epicenter of this.
Yes. I volunteer in a program for children whose most of the children have parents who abuse drugs. And, I mean, we could talk for days on that topic. But to have a conservative attitude that by not exchanging needles is going to accomplish anything, change people's behavior, is absurd.
Phyllis, thank you very much. Let me ask you, Beth Meyerson, I asked Julie about this, but I'll pose it to you. You know, so many people, as Phyllis mentioned, are opposed to the needle exchange program, saying it doesn't do any good. It perpetuates drug use. It doesn't stop it. Is that a valid concern?
Well, I think that the education about the effectiveness of needle exchange is really important, and Phyllis brings that point, that we need to continue to communicate what we know about the science of needle exchange. 30 years of evidence have indicated that they not only reduce hepatitis C and HIV in using populations, but they don't increase needles on the street. But I think what Phyllis is getting to is a deeper issue, and that is, again, where it's abstinence versus harm reduction. So if you tend to be a person that says, well, condoms need to be part of our education around sexual health, or we need to wear seat belts, or we need to use a helmet, or we could wear a patch for tobacco, you're kind of in the harm reduction piece, and you might be inclined to listen to the science of needle exchange. I think drug use is so stigmatized, and injection drug use even more, that we don't have the community awareness that we need to have. Now, Phyllis, I will share, if you're still on the line, that the governor did sign a law that will allow any community to raise their hands through their health directors to have a syringe exchange. And I think the good thing about the way this law was written, I call it a gauntlet in an op-ed, but it really is actually a good three-step process, because it requires the community to be engaged in the conversation, so that as a health director raises their hand and says, okay, we are going to declare an epidemic of HIV or hepatitis among injection drug users, that's step one. The county executive body or municipality's legislative body will have to accept that declaration, and they will engage the community in a hearing around that. And then it goes to our state health commissioner to determine whether a declaration is in fact appropriate and a needle exchange can proceed. The good news, though, about having that step of the community engagement is for not only a chance to educate about our problems together and our challenges together and our views about things, but also to gain community support so something sustains. So let's take Scott County, for example. Here's a county that a needle exchange was declared for under emergency orders under the governor. And I know that was a hard decision for him, because he is an abstinence guy. So I got to give him kudos for that. And so the other piece of this, though, is, did Scott County raise their hand? So a year before, Ed Clare, who's a Republican from Floyd County, had actually led the discussion for a syringe exchange bill. It just didn't get approved by the Senate. It got out of the House. And so this Herculean bipartisan effort that he led this time that resulted in the law, had that happened last year, I'm not frankly sure Scott County would have raised their hands, even though they well knew they had an injection drug use issue in their community with OPANA. Mm. And so this is why this step is important in community building around an idea of public health.
Mm-hmm. Matthew is in Evansville, Indiana, also near the epicenter of this. Matthew, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I wanted to say I really appreciate you all covering this topic today. It's pretty close to my heart. And I just wanted to relate. I've had a lot of close friends dealing with opiate addiction since really back in 2010 or 2011, where people were mostly snorting OPANAs and drugs like that. And then in 2012, it was like somebody decided to bring heroin in town, and needle use just took off from there. So I just wanted to say, you know, I appreciate y'all talking about it, but the public health aspect is really symptomatic of an issue that's been going on for far too long, and in my eyes, without being appropriately addressed. And I just wanted to ask y'all to comment on the ways in which it would be better for the state to address this issue from the aspect of preventative treatment and dealing with, quote-unquote, the war on drugs on a, you know, social preventative level instead of a criminalizing approach.
All right, Matthew. Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. Beth Meyerson?
This is really a great conversation, and thank you, Matthew, for that. There are a couple of things that I would want to share, too. That attitude of criminalization versus human service is also part of this abstinence versus harm reduction perspective, but it gets translated through human service organizations within communities. And in fact, then there are policies that, oh, you can't get services if you are not if you are still using. So it further shuts off populations from any health care at all, again, enhancing the need for a syringe exchange, because sometimes those programs are the only linkage a person who injects drugs has with any health care system or service. And so what Matthew is pointing to is that it's not just at the state level, it's pervasive throughout our human service and public health culture, and we have to address that. But frankly, the fact that you have to go to court to get to treatment that's affordable, meaning free to you then, is a problem. And so it all goes around the emphasis for criminalizing versus understanding and addressing.
Matthew, thanks for the call. A lot of listeners in on this. Comments from our website. Here's one. One complication is our insistence on treating drug use as if it were a moral failure. Because of this, we'd rather have drug users share needles and die of AIDS than give them reasonable access to clean needles to take their drugs. That would be promoting bad behavior. Here's Sarah in Nashville, Tennessee. Sarah, glad you called. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
For letting me talk.
Sure.
I was just calling to talk about, I am a former junkie, IV drug user.
Okay.
And was when I was younger, I ended up with a horrible infection in my arm. And it would have been very helpful to have a needle exchange here in Nashville when that happened. And it's really easy to slip into sharing needles. I think a lot of people look at that as maybe just a weird thing. But from my experience, it was just very easy.
I'll bring this point up again, and I hear what you're saying, but what do you say to those people who say it just perpetuates the problem? You're enabling people like Sarah. What's your response to that, having been in this situation?
You're going to find a way. If you're hooked, you're hooked. You're going to find a way. You're going to find a needle no matter what. And I had, you know, when I used to go and pick them up at a pharmacy, and they would sell them kind of under the counter. It was totally not legal in order to get clean needles. I didn't even know about needle exchanges until a little bit later, and a friend moved to Nashville. I think she was from New York, and she was like, why don't you guys have these here? It's ridiculous. Why are you guys all sharing? Why are you using old needles? And then, you know, the problems that come with doing that, you know, needles breaking off in your arms, ending up with infections that can kill you too, just besides HIV.
Sarah,
other complications that come with using dirty needles.
Thank you very much for the call. Congratulations on being clean. I appreciate you calling. You want to talk about that? Beth Meyerson, also in Indiana. I think I read, correct me if I'm wrong, but they are selling needles over the counter?
Yeah, there are. You can get a syringe over the counter at pharmacies. This is high discretion of pharmacists. Some require prescription, and others don't. And incidentally, it just really depends on where you are in a community. Let me just say, Sarah, I really, really appreciate that you told the story of real experience around needle sharing, because it does show there is clear awareness. We want to judge people who do certain things that we don't do or whatever. And what you're really saying is that it's not difficult to understand why access to needles will be a big issue, because we would share. It's what's driven. You're really needing to shoot up. You're not going to say, oh, wait, I'm going to go to the pharmacy and hope they're going to sell me an exchange a needle. The other thing you bring up, Sarah, that I think is really critical is that there's a lot of tissue damage that's associated with injection, and it isn't just hepatitis C, and it isn't just HIV. And so a lot of healthcare needs could be addressed, but it has to happen in this trusting relationship that's not going to judge somebody, take them to jail, arrest them, or whatever, for a clean needle. I will also say something that emerged as a result of what was happening in Scott County, too, and it's in every community, and this is great. It's a hope, really, is that even in the context of Scott, where people would inject up to 10 times a day because of the way the high worked with Opana, you saw people in the community of users helping each other. So one might pick up way more needles than necessary, which is good because the one-to-one is not a great thing. But they would share them with others because of it. They knew, we want to get these clean needles to our colleagues, our family members who are shooting and need them. And that, to me, is hopeful and shows care.
Oh. Hi, this is Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for listening. Audible.com is our sponsor today. Audible.com carries over 180,000 book titles, plus magazines and newspapers. Many of the books we talk about on the show can be downloaded and listened to whenever, wherever you want. And as an incentive to get you to try this service, they're offering On Point listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint, download a free title, and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint to get started today.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about an outbreak of HIV in rural Indiana and what we need to learn from it. We're speaking this hour with Julie Foltz, HIV Program Manager at Aspire Indiana, a nonprofit community mental health center. She's been working with HIV patients in Scott County, and with Beth Meyerson, professor in the School of Public Health at Indiana University, which she is co-director of the Rural Center for AIDS and STD Prevention. Here's some sound earlier this month, a school newspaper editor in rural Indiana speaking with PBS NewsHour about the measures students are taking to get things under control.
Very quickly, it changed from indecisiveness about what we do, about what we need to do, to what we need to do. We talked to the deputy state health commissioner, and we had people come in and educated the entire high school and most of the middle school on the how it's contracted and how you can spread it.
Julie Foltz, jump back in here and talk about education. There's a young man talking about the need for it, the younger population certainly dealing with this along with some of the older folks. But I know you've talked to folks who are wondering about the basics of HIV and AIDS. A woman wanted to know whether her infected son-in-law could come into the house, touch the remote control, you know, use the bathroom, these sorts of things. Can you talk about those experiences that you've had?
Sure. I actually had similar conversations with multiple people when I was in Austin, the same types of things about, are my children safe? Is it okay to exchange money at the grocery store? Can someone who's infected eat off my dishes? Going way back to the beginning of HIV education that we used to do years ago, I just think that it seems that we've become complacent, and everybody's just been okay with the status quo. And so the education piece has died out. Mm. And so I think that's really important to get that back in. And I know that there are many people who have spent time in Scott County doing education, as well as some of the surrounding counties, bringing back that basic HIV 101 type education.
And also preventative drug treatment, right?
And I don't know that that's something that I can speak on. I don't know if Dr. Meyerson can talk on that a little bit more than I can.
Got it. Let's go to a call here in Chicago, Illinois. Cullen is on the line. Cullen, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I just kind of wanted to speak a little bit to some of the costs that I guess is involved. I'm a pharmacist, and I know that a lot of people that get diagnosed with HIV, most of them are probably going to be put on a medication called Truvada. Mm-hmm. That's very successful medication, you know, keeps the counts down and everything, but it costs, I mean, out of pocket, without insurance, around $2,000 a month. Mm. And if you have the state paying for that, I mean, that's the state eating that alive. So you're talking in this one county, 150 people, that's $300,000 a month. What's that? You know, $3.6 million a year just for the medicine, you know, to keep it under control. This isn't talking about labs and diagnosis and triage and everything like that that comes with it. But, I mean, that's a lot of money for one county.
Cullen, thank you. And I think the point that Cullen and many others may make, Beth Meyerson, is that perhaps it's cheaper on this end to deal with the issue than to treat full-blown HIV AIDS.
Yes, absolutely. And I, you know, again, they add up because you're thinking, gosh, you know, now that we've identified Beth with hepatitis C, she has to have antiretroviral treatment there. And we now identified that she's co-infected with HIV. But as you would hear from clinicians who are providing the care within Scott County alone, many of the users who are in their medical care have had no physical health care at all. And so there's a myriad health issues facing them. So again, prevention is definitely the way to go. But I will say this, I am sure part of the problem why we didn't, for instance, why the governor did not put forward any new money for HIV testing in surrounding counties or in injection drug using counties, I'm sure they don't want to know what the need is. Because again, as mentioned by the caller, they'd have to respond. And this is very cynical and really bad. But I mean, again, if you waved your magic wand and said, gosh, this is happening in Scott, not only should we respond to the outbreak right now, but let's put some money into every community in Indiana so they can screen their injection drug using populations. And we can screen around the counties surrounding Scott to find out what the health status is. But of course, in doing so, you own it.
Let's go to the West Coast for a moment. San Francisco, California is where Katie Boucher is, Syringe Access Services Manager at the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. Last year, her program handed out 2.5 million syringes to 32,000 addicts. Katie Boucher, so nice to have you. Thanks for taking the time.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So you run this needle exchange program in San Francisco, one of five such programs in the city. How large is this? How many sites and where are they?
So we, as a program, operate 11 sites during the week. As a collaborative amongst the five programs, we operate, I think, 22 sites each week. So there is needle exchange and syringe access every day of the week, including Sundays. And we're spread out in various neighborhoods in the city. We're indoors, we're outdoors, we're on mobile outreach, we have fixed sites. We really try to meet drug users where they're at in terms of their geographic location as well as where they are along the substance use continuum.
Also, it sounds as though that the needle exchange program that you run is a way to introduce people to other services, people who might otherwise simply fall through the cracks.
Definitely. Some of the folks that come in and use the needle exchange, we may be the only services that they're accessing at all. So that might be their only point of medical care access. It is sometimes folks' only chance to form relationships with people. Drug users, you know, face such stigma within the community and within society. We get a lot of reports of drug users not being treated very well when they seek services and other community agencies.
And so what do people say to you when they come for your service? Do you find they're grateful for your service? Is it, what are the emotions?
People are definitely grateful. That's one thing when I first started as a volunteer almost 15 years ago, I was, you know, really surprised to see how thankful people were, especially folks that have been using the program longer, folks that remember what it was like before needle exchange, are very grateful. People are very polite and thankful for the services that they get, and appreciate people supporting them, even though they might be using drugs.
And I'll ask you, as I've asked our other guests this hour, what is your response to those who oppose such programs, who oppose the opportunity to needle exchange with drug addicts? They say it perpetuates this issue. You are enabling those people who have drug addiction. Is that a valid concern, and how have you seen that play out in San Francisco?
Well, there is always people that have those concerns. Like to say, yes, we do enable people, but we enable people to keep living and to lead healthier lives. There's been lots of research over the past 20 years that shows that As opposed to increasing drug use, it actually links people to detox and treatment and helps people stay in treatment. Like a caller was saying earlier, it's very cost effective. It's not shown to increase crime. It links people to other services. And it does not increase drug use. So there's lots of research out there. And I think that's what I would have to say to those folks.
Katie Boucher, Syringe Access Services Manager, the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. Last year, the San Francisco Foundation handed out 2.5 million syringes to about 32,000 people. Katie Boucher, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Beth Meyerson, when you hear what's happening there in San Francisco, you hear Katie, you must want something like that in Indiana. But I'll throw out there, San Francisco is a very different place, very different politics, very different history with AIDS. How do you respond to what you hear there?
Absolutely. And in fact, there are programs as close as Chicago. In fact, Dan Bigg and his colleagues came down. There's a harm reduction coalition in Monroe County that understand all of these issues that Katie had shared and the benefits of these programs. But you have to get a community there. Quick story to give you where we really are in the process of moving this syringe exchange bill through the legislature. You encountered this Malthusian perspective about, you know, let them die. And this was really paired with disconnected views of those who already have their health needs met. So we saw this in expression around, hey, don't screen because we learn what the need will be and then have to pour money into it, or why would you want a syringe exchange because it requires a system that's not broken and you're saying the system is broken. And, you know, all of this leads me to ask, look, would you not offer a flotation device to someone just because you weren't sure the boat could hold them? And this is where we are in Indiana. And the only way to move through it is by really engaging our communities to address each other. In Scott County, you had two towns, 1960 Scott County, Beaver Cleaver, or thought they were, and this community of like zombie land of users who were in the throes of addiction, multi-generational, completely separate. No doctor would test screen. There was no reach of the public health system in this community. And that is in several communities. And so you have to be honest about that first before we move forward. And this law will actually allow that to take place. The question I have is whether we have the collective public health leadership with the skills to do it. Just plugging a needle exchange program in a county that doesn't want it will not serve the users. They will be in danger.
Danger in what way, Beth Meyerson?
So in Scott County, where we had temporary syringe exchanges, is that going to end and I'm going to be arrested after that? So coming out to get a new syringe, I'm now identified and marked and I can be arrested after that. That's one. The other is I now admit that I'm a user and I'm marked in the community socially. I'm going to feel like a junkie every time I come in to get any services. So maybe being isolated, disconnected, and in my own world was better. So you have to appreciate these kinds of things. In 2011, we did a secret shopper study of all the HIV testing sites in Indiana, and we learned that one in five attempts failed to get a test. And our ethnographers, some of whom were former injection drug users, reported to us, hey, I just felt like a junkie. And so you know that's very, very clear. If a community does not reach into its own reserves and decide to accept the wealth of who we are and move forward together to do something courageous like a syringe exchange or invest in public health, we will be nowhere in the long run.
Let's get some calls in here. Marco in Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Marco. Glad you waited. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And everything I've heard in the last few minutes really affirms what I want to say. I find the notion of equating these programs with, you know, promoting drug use or facilitating or perpetuating, I find that reprehensible because the programs are kind of a statement about the value of human life, even the life of people who are addicts. And I think that question turns the whole thing into a referendum on drug addiction. And I think kind of like one of your commenters, just your guest, just said, not only do these programs allow us to accept and reaffirm the value of those people who are addicted, but it allows those people who are addicted the opportunity to make a moral choice. And even if they can't rescue themselves from their addiction, they can make a moral choice to prevent the spread to other people.
Glad you called, Marco. Thank you. Thank you very much. Here's Gretchen in Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Gretchen. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have two comments.
Yep.
First, I grew up in California. I have type 1 diabetes and found out
after high school when we were in college that one of my brother's dearest best friends had been taking my needles that I wasn't using and using them for his drug use, and keeping them, obviously not giving them back. And he came to us and told us he had done this. And all I could say is thank God he was able to have the addiction that he had and not have HIV. And he's living, he's been sober for 12 years, has a full life. And the other part is education, which is I've been really surprised in the last couple of weeks. I've had two different friends who are HIV positive, who have had issues in the workplace. One of them is a makeup artist, and someone complained that he had done her makeup, and he was HIV positive. And I said, well, did you share a needle with her? Did you cut her? Did you spit on her? No. I said, then how on earth could she have contracted AIDS?
Come down to education. I'm so glad you called, Gretchen. The clock's against me here, and I need to get one last question in for our guest. Julie Foltz, you said that here in Indiana, we're just one needle away from an outbreak in another location. This is serious business down where you are and what you see every day, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that catching the outbreak, if you will, in Scott County, we were fortunate to do that. There are so many other small rural towns that are having the same opiate addiction epidemic that it just takes one shared needle, and we're having the same thing again.
And Beth Meyerson, you give the last word here. What are the lessons for other cities, for other towns in this country, playing off of what Julie just said?
So know your data. So we have published by county hepatitis C rates and overdose rates for opioids. If you're a community that's dealing with opioid addiction, you're likely having your neighbors and friends shooting it. You got to know your data. And the RCAP website will have that for Indiana. So Indiana communities that feel like they're one needle away from an outbreak, know it, be empowered by that, and connect with each other to move the discussion forward.
Beth Meyerson, co-director for the Rural Center for AIDS and STD Prevention at Indiana University. Really appreciate your time and expertise, Beth. Thank you.
Glad to be with you.
Julie Foltz, HIV Program Manager at Aspire Indiana. Thank you for being with us, and thanks for your work, Julie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You can continue the conversation, the important conversation, listeners, at our website and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Listeners, as always, thank you for your insights. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.